Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Tom Vilsack has been the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture throughout President Obama's two terms in the White House. He talked with WPSU's Emily Reddy while he was in town for a first-ever series of White House rural forums. The conversation took place before the election, but Vilsack was already planning to move on from the position with the end of Obama's presidency. He actually considered leaving about a year ago, but President Obama convinced him to stay by giving him an important new assignment, combating the opioid crisis.
Well, first, thank you for talking with us, Secretary Vilsack.
Happy to be here. I'm happy to be back in my home state of Pennsylvania.
That's right. You're from Pittsburgh, right?
That's correct.
And you were recently profiled in the Washington Post. In that article, you call rural America a forgotten place. In what ways do you think it's forgotten, and how do we get Washington to care about rural America?
Well, I think there's a growing awareness of the importance that rural America is to the rest of the country, but I think sometimes policymakers have a tendency to think where most of the people are, that's where most of the action is. You know, we're now only 15% of America's population, so their focus of policymakers is often on the 85% that live in urban and suburban areas. But now, as a result of the aggressive efforts of USDA and the president, we have really focused the attention of the financial community, of the economic development community, of the human services community on some of the challenges, needs, and opportunities that are fairly significant in rural areas. So we're beginning to see more investment. We're beginning to see an integration and coordination of programs. The president put together the Rural Council, first time ever, all federal agencies impacting rural America now working collaboratively together. And that's resulted in a substantial number of new business growth, job growth opportunities in rural areas. So we're getting there. I think my comment about the forgotten America, I think, was in the context of the opioid epidemic, which has been something that Pennsylvania's been dealing with and every state has been dealing with. It's a serious epidemic. We have to be serious about meeting it. I know Governor Wolf is encouraging the Pennsylvania legislature to provide the resources for the state to combine with the federal effort to expand treatment, to encourage more prevention activities, and to make sure that physicians that are prescribing these opioids are doing it in a wise and appropriate way.
And in that article, you talk about feeling like you didn't have enough to sink your teeth into, enough important work to do. Maybe you laugh, maybe that's not exactly how you meant it. But you say that and you get handed the opioid crisis.
Well, I have an incredible team that works at USDA, and they were doing amazing work. We're doing quite a bit of activity at USDA. I mean, we made some announcements here today, over $50 million of additional assistance and help, over $30 million, rather, of additional assistance and help for rural communities. USDA is doing this every single day. But I needed more of a challenge. I needed more work to do to keep me busy, and the president asked if I would take on this issue of opioids. And we've made progress. We have new CDC guidelines for prescribing of opioids. We have a training taking place with physicians today to teach them better and more appropriate uses of opioids, appropriate dosages of opioids. We have medical schools, nursing schools, pharmacy schools recrafting their curriculum so that pain management is taught more effectively. We have expanded opportunities for reversal drugs like naloxone and Narcan being made more available to first responders make sure that people who are in an overdose circumstance, their lives can be saved. So we've seen expansion of that. We've seen some expansion of the treatment capacity, but we need a lot more, which is why the president has asked Congress for $1.1 billion. Congress passed a law, and people talk about this law. It's called the CARA law. It's a fine law. It basically reaffirms what we were already doing, but it didn't have any resources behind it. And unless we have significant investment to expand significantly treatment, we're not going to get our arms around the totality of this problem. People, when they seek treatment, when they are anxious to have treatment, they need to be able to access it. And particularly in rural areas where only 25 of the over 1,000 behavioral service centers that provide this treatment are located in rural areas, you can see there's a tremendous need for investment in treatment facilities.
We've heard from police officers here in State College around the nation who are carrying Narcan, who some of them think that that's sort of out of their purview. They don't want that responsibility, think that EMS workers and doctors should be doing that. What's your response to a police officer who says it's too much of a responsibility?
Well, first of all, always appreciative of what law enforcement does for us in terms of protecting us. And I think part of the situation is sometimes law enforcement is asked to protect us from ourselves. They go into a lot of dangerous circumstances and situations where people are doing unlawful behavior. And in an effort to try to protect that individual and protect others, they put themselves in harm's way. So I appreciate that they've got a tough job. They unfortunately oftentimes find themselves being the first person on the scene. And oftentimes that reversal drug can be the difference between life and death. And I would imagine that most police officers, if they're adequately trained, will understand the importance of doing this. And there are now nasal spray applications that are relatively simple. It's just like a little thing of Afrin in a way that you can use very easy. It doesn't require a lot of expertise, doesn't require dealing with needles, doesn't require any of that complicated stuff. It is basically you take it, you squirt it in the person's nose and a dose or two, and the person is saved. I think we have made it simpler for them to do life-saving activities, and I think as they learn more about the availability of these less cumbersome ways of providing that initial life protection, they'll be more interested in doing it.
This is an issue that hits close to home for you. During these efforts to fight the opioid epidemic, you've talked about your mother's battle with addiction. How does that family history inform your current work?
Well, first of all, it's one of the reasons why I took this challenge on, because I understood my mom suffered through the same types of challenges that people are suffering through today, and I saw her get on the other side of her addiction. But I also understood that she was able to do that not only through her faith and courage, but also with a lot of help, which is why I'm so focused on making sure that when people reach that magic moment as she did, where they are prepared to accept help and prepared to utilize help, help has to be available. That's why it's important to expand treatment capacity. It's why it's important for faith-based communities to allow us to have a conversation about opioid addiction in the right context. This is not a character flaw. This is not a little willpower and you can get yourself in a different place. This is a disease, and it has to be treated as a disease. It has to be prioritized as a disease. We talk about cancer. We talk about diabetes. We talk about heart conditions. We talk about loved ones who have those physical conditions, and we express sympathy. We express concern. We express a willingness to help. This addiction is in the same category, and I think we have to approach it in the same way. And if we had that attitude, I think we would be able to get resources to expand treatment to make it more readily available, that we would understand that mental health, substance use disorder are basically no different than diabetes, heart disease, cancer. They are diseases that and illnesses that have to be treated. And there have to be professionals, there have to be staff, there have to be facilities. That does require commitment, does require resources, and it requires us to make this a priority and to understand precisely what this is. My mom's experience, I think, allows me to understand the issue a little bit deeper and a little bit better, to also sympathize with those who are struggling with the addiction, because I watched her deal with it, and also to sympathize and sort of align myself with the family members that want to help, that want to turn their loved one's life around, but just don't have enough, don't have the resources, don't have the help, don't have the assistance that they need.
I want to talk a little more about why you're here today. You're here for the White House Rural Forum. What is that? I've been told it's the first of its kind.
Well, the Rural Council was established by the president, by an executive order, and it was essentially a direction to all the executive branch departments, the Department of Labor, Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, Health and Human Services, Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Justice, USDA. All these departments basically have been working in their own little siloed, in their own little sphere of influence. The Rural Council basically brings us together, puts us around the table, and we basically begin to leverage and coordinate and integrate our programs with several goals. One, to make sure that we reduce barriers to access to programs, because sometimes it's very difficult for people to access the federal programs. They don't know what the federal programs are. If they do know what they are, they don't know how to apply for them. If they do know how to apply, they don't apply well because they're not trained. It can be hard. And so how can we lessen the burden? How can we increase access. How can we leverage those federal resources by leveraging them within the federal family, by making sure that we're investing in the same places the Department of Transportation or Department of Commerce may be investing in economic opportunity? How can we do the same thing at USDA, for example, or work collaboratively with EPA or the Department of Labor? And also, how do we basically educate people about where the need is through data and through information that we can provide so that people know how to focus and target the resources to, in the most persistently poor areas and the areas that need help the most. So this Rural Council was put together for those purposes, and I think it's been incredibly successful. We have seen tens of millions of dollars now being utilized in places that were not receiving help before. So it's provided for better coordination. It's provided for a better understanding in the departments about the need of rural America. We're getting the private foundations, the private sector, private businesses more engaged in investing. We're seeing an expansion of credit opportunities. The CoBank, which is a farm credit bank, committed $3 billion already to a $10 billion commitment they made to invest in infrastructure. So there's just new businesses, new opportunities being created, and new excitement being created as a result of the Rural Council.
And how did you decide to have that here in State College at Penn State?
Well, we're doing a series of forums around the country. And, you know, the beauty of Penn State is that it's a great university dedicated into so many aspects of rural life, but it's also located in a rural place. A lot of these land-grant universities are located in cities. They have a mission to help rural America, but they're not in rural America. With the beautiful landscape that surrounds this campus, it's a perfect place to have a conversation about rural development, the role of universities, the role of private sector, the role of federal and state government and local government in helping to invest in rural communities. And Penn State certainly has done a good job of that and continues to do a good job of that.
You are listening to Take Note on WPSU. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tom Vilsack, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. He talked with WPSU's Emily Reddy about the challenges facing agriculture and rural America.
Immigration has been a major talking point in this election. What impact do you think tighter immigration laws would have on food supply and cost, and why?
Well, I can talk about President Obama's attitude about immigration and the attitude of farm families that I talk to. We need a safe, secure supply of labor, and one that we can rely on. And the sad reality today, because of the broken immigration system that we have in this country, in many parts of the country, we are not harvesting that which we grow, and we're not growing that which we can, because there is no guarantee that there would be a labor supply either to plant it, harvest it. And in some circumstances, crops that are being grown are not harvested in a timely basis because there simply are not the hands to harvest. So it's an unfortunate circumstance where, because of a broken immigration system, we're not reaching our maximum potential when it comes to agricultural production. And that obviously has an impact on farmers, it has an impact on rural communities, it has an impact on job numbers in rural areas. And it's something that has to get resolved. You know, we have a patchwork system today that doesn't work particularly well. It's cumbersome. It's difficult. If we had comprehensive immigration reform, as the president has proposed, if we have the ability of the 11 million people or so that are in this country who did not enter it legally, who don't have adequate documentation, if we are able to bring those folks out of the shadow, give them a long pathway to legitimacy and citizenship, have them pay a fine, have them pay back taxes if they owe back taxes, if they've committed a crime, then obviously that's a different circumstance. But assuming they haven't, give them a pathway, create a system that secures our borders, and create a system where we have a better, more accurate read of precisely who's in and who's not here and when they came and when they're leaving. All of that would provide that stability and assurance that we would have a labor supply that would then be enable farmers to make decisions about what to grow, and when to harvest, which in turn would result in more supply, which will provide consumers, obviously, more choice. I think the fact that we are incredibly efficient would ensure that we would continue to provide affordable food in this country, and we would also be able to expand export opportunities. That would help feed hungry people in other countries. So there's no downside to immigration reform as it relates to agriculture. We've got to have it.
Another barrier, I'd say, to the United States doing as much farming as its capacity to, is the rapidly aging farmer population, a declining number of farms and farmers. What's the USDA doing to help aspiring farmers start successful agricultural businesses?
Each year we make millions of dollars of grants to land-grant universities, to other nonprofit organizations that are working with us to encourage young people to get into the farming business. That's the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program. It provides the opportunity for individuals to learn a little bit about the questions they have to ask themselves, the decisions they have to make in order to get into the farming business, and the resources that are available, whether it's a microloan from the USDA or whether it's a tunnel house to extend a growing season from NRCS or a crop insurance policy from the Risk Management Agency. The Beginning Farmer Development Program gives young farmers the ability to understand the business plan they have to put together. We are redirecting most of the credit, the majority of the credit that we provide to beginning farmers and ranchers, so that the government is helping to fund those who have the greatest need for capital and credit at the beginning of their farming operation. We're carving out exceptions and benefits for young farmers on issues involving the cost of crop insurance or conservation cost share, making it a little bit easier for them to participate in those programs. We're making a concerted pitch to expand the diversity of producers in this country in terms of reaching out to people of color, women, and specifically veterans, a very aggressive effort to try to encourage returning veterans who have been in war, torn areas for a considerable period of time, who are looking for the nurturing aspect of agriculture to sort of rebuild themselves and to strengthen themselves and to deal with the horrors of war in a more positive way. We've created new opportunities for veterans to get involved in this business and frankly, to get interested in agriculture generally. We're also working with colleges like Penn State to encourage young people to understand that there are careers in agriculture. Purdue University did a study that shows that we have a significant shortage of people that meet the need that's growing for a variety of jobs in agriculture. I think they indicated there are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 opportunities in the next 3 or 4 years, but we're only probably training and educating about half that number today. So there's tremendous opportunity here. Making sure people know about those opportunities, making sure they know about the programs to help them, making sure that they are thinking thoughtfully about how they get into this business, and then expanding markets, creating not just a commodity market opportunity, which existed before, but also a local and regional market where young farmers, beginning farmers, can sell directly to their customers as opposed to selling to a commodity market where they have no control over price.
So community-supported agriculture and farmers markets aside, with fewer and fewer Americans farming, we're more removed from the source of our food than we've ever been before. And Americans don't always have a favorable view of modern farming. Farm runoff is a big problem in the Chesapeake Bay area. We're concerned about GMOs. How do you change Americans' perceptions of modern farming?
Well, first of all, let me speak specifically to the Chesapeake Bay, because I think farmers in the Bay Area are stepping up. We recently did a report on the condition of the Bay, and we're actually seeing, because of voluntary conservation practices by farmers, 99% of all the acres in the Chesapeake Bay watershed are currently engaged in some conservation practice, 99%. That's pretty impressive. 52% of those acres at any point in time in a four-year period will have a cover crop over it. And the result of all that conservation practice has resulted in a reduction of the hypoxic area within the Chesapeake Bay, an increase in expansion of the underground grassways that basically provide habitat for fish and oysters and crabs. And we've seen a resurgence of the crab, the blue crab. We've seen a resurgence of oysters and fish. So it's working. So we're going to continue to obviously promote that voluntary stewardship efforts in conservation, and we're going to continue to provide cost share resources for farmers to do the right thing on their land. And I think the key for us is to get the message out that farmers are responding to the challenges that are confronting them and are investing lots of their own resource, combining with lots of resources from the government, to get our waterways in better shape. And agriculture is doing its part. In fact, most of the improvement within the Chesapeake Bay is a result of agriculture's aggressive activity. So getting that message out is important. I think it is also important to remind people about what they're able to do with their lives and what they're able to do with their paycheck, because they have this incredible engine called American agricultural production. all of us who are not farmers have the luxury of not being a farmer because we've delegated the responsibility to a relatively small number of people who are producing the food that we consume. And when we walk out of a grocery store as a people, as a country, we spend less as a percentage of our income for food than just about anybody in the world. So we have greater flexibility with our lives and greater flexibility with our paychecks because of American agriculture. And these are people that send their sons and daughters disproportionately into the military. 15% of America's population, 40% of America's military. So they make a tremendous contribution to the country. And I think part of what we need to do is we need to market that more effectively. And I think we need to create a dialogue about agriculture that removes the fear and the concern and the uncertainty about certain technologies, to reassure people that the food they're consuming is safe, to reassure people that there are regulatory systems in place to make sure that we're not injecting something into the food supply that's dangerous, and that we now, with the new labeling law, will be in a position to provide information to consumers who are interested in having that information, so there'll be greater transparency within agriculture and within agribusiness, which I think is important.
With increased flooding in some areas and drought in others, climate change seems like it's increasingly making farming unpredictable. Do you have plans for helping farmers deal with these problems with climate change?
Well, we actually have several years ago established a series of climate hubs. These are research operations, and it's a joint effort between the Forest Service, the Conservation Service, and our Agricultural Research Service and land-grant universities. And the idea behind the these climate hubs is to basically have in each region of the country and focusing with sub-hubs, what are called sub-hubs for specialty crops for the Caribbean and for forests. Each region of the country, we've now done a thorough assessment of the vulnerabilities of climate change in agriculture and forestry. So in each region of the country, we have a detailed understanding of what's happening with the climate and how that's impacting and will impact production and forestry. We're now putting together a series of strategies for allowing farmers to adapt and mitigate to the changing circumstances of their farming operation or their forest. So now they're going to be able to have the tools to be able to make adjustments. In some cases, we're going to see longer growing seasons. In some cases, we're going to see shorter growing seasons. In some cases, we're going to see what we were producing, we won't be able to produce there. We'll have to produce it someplace else. We're also engaging farmers in an effort to reduce emissions so that we can mitigate the consequences of climate by reducing the emissions, future emissions. Right now, through conservation practices and activities of farmers, we've eliminated in the last several years about 60 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent from farming operations. Roughly 8 or 9% of all emissions are related to U.S. emissions are related to agriculture. We want to double the rate of emission reductions over the next 10 years, and we've created a series of building blocks designed to give farmers the ability to reduce through better crop and soil management, through better irrigation systems, through rotational grazing, through the use of renewable energy, through urban forests, through better utilization of forests on private and public lands, a variety of strategies that we know for a fact will reduce emissions related to agriculture. And that will allow the country to help meet its threshold of reducing overall emissions by 26% to 28%, which we agreed to do in Paris. It's part of the agreement. So agriculture is playing its part. Agriculture has been aggressive in this area. We're providing farmers with the tools and the information and the awareness through extension, through our land-grant university systems, and through these climate hubs and sub-hubs.
You mentioned extension. That is a huge issue here at Penn State. Every year when the state budget time rolls around, people are afraid that they're going to lose their jobs and they're leaving before those funds are even cut. What can states do about this, and can the USDA do anything to help?
Well, the USDA is a strong supporter of land-grant universities, and we have a variety of different ways we help, through formula funding, which is sort of a dedicated source of money that goes to land grants, and then there are competitive grant programs that USDA makes available to Penn State. I think the provost mentioned that the investment in Penn State from USDA was increased by 6% last year, so we are putting more resources behind the efforts here at Penn State. The issue of extension, I think, is one where people may not be fully aware of what extension does. Certainly state legislators, governors may not be fully appreciative of the broad array of responsibilities that Extension takes on. And I think, frankly, we at the federal level, we at the state level need to do a better job, and we at the university level need to do a better job of connecting Extension services to ordinary folks so that they understand and appreciate what they get with the Extension service, so that they in turn can convince their policymakers to make Extension funding more of a priority than it has been.
What do you think are the biggest threats to our food system and food security in the United States?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd start with the fact that we currently waste about 30% or so of the food that we do produce. So one threat to being able to produce enough to continue to feed an increasing world population and an increasing U.S. population here is to reduce food waste. I think climate, obviously, we mentioned it before, but I think a changing climate is a significant challenge for, and an opportunity, frankly, for us to sort of rethink agriculture and to equip farmers and ranchers with tools to be able to deal with the changes that will occur so that their productivity is not compromised. I think the attitude about science among ordinary folks can also be a serious challenge. Science in the agricultural space is really amazing stuff. These scientists that work in labs like the ones here at Penn State, they're like detectives. They're figuring out how to solve the crime, how to solve a pest or disease, how to change the makeup of a seed to enable it to be more stronger, to be able to resist a pest or disease. And I think there's a lack of understanding about that science and therefore a distrust of the science that has creeped into our thought process, which is made it more difficult for us to get these scientific advancements through a process, through a regulatory process, or through an approval process, and certainly more difficult in terms of the rest of the world. And I think there are, I think we need to take a much better progressive look at science and appreciate and respect the science that says, yes, you can develop seeds that are drought resistant so that farmers can still produce lots of crops even when it's dry as a bone. You know, we had a drought not long ago that was pretty dramatic throughout the entire United States, still obviously a problem on the West Coast, but I would have expected that in that drought of a couple of years ago that we would have seen marked reductions in corn production, for example. But we had, I think, the fifth or eighth largest corn crop in the country because we had new science, new drought-resistant seeds. We shouldn't be wary of those. We shouldn't be critical of those. We should be understanding the opportunity they create for us to grow more on less, for us to use less pesticide and chemicals. And I think the industry finally has awakened to the need for greater transparency, not to be afraid of educating consumers about how food is produced and where it's produced and what processes are used. The more we educate, I think the better it will be for agriculture and the easier it will be to make sure that the science that's new, gene editing is coming in now, where you essentially don't have to add something foreign to the DNA of a seed, but you can actually take something out of the seed's DNA or alter it a little bit so that it doesn't create the problems that you've had in the past. We need to educate people about what that is and what it isn't. We need to get them comfortable with that notion so that we don't have the kind of backlash we've seen with GMOs.
Thank you for talking with me.
You bet. Thank you.
That was WPSU's Emily Reddy talking with Tom Vilsack, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, about the challenges facing agriculture and rural America. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.